Oh, you have to unmute yourself.
Yep, there we go. I'm changing from speaker view to gallery view. There we go. I don't need to talk to myself. Oh, so I can do that by myself with myself. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much, Yvonne, and everyone in the committee and everyone who put this event together. I've been here since, I think, about 11 this morning and been listening to so many awesome speakers and shares and just the love and the camaraderie and the warmth this whole day. And I'm grateful that I get to be a part of that. And then I just help to conclude. I'm not sure how much time do I have. When do I stop sharing? I can't hear you, Yvonne.
You're the last person. You got 45 minutes to an hour, Teresa. Have at it.
Okay, thank you. I'm always nervous and certainly more intimidated. I was saying there's always sometimes a share before I share. And as I've been listening all day, I'm like, oh, yeah, I should say. So I've been editing all the way. I've been editing and editing. And then what I always find is ultimately I'm going to share what I'm supposed to share. And then everyone's going to miss out on such a wonderful share afterwards. You'll get to hear all my final draft when I get done. And only I'm the only one that's going to get to hear that one. But I'm always have a share before I share, and that is that I'm always uncomfortable and I feel intimidated and extremely vulnerable. This is a very intimate proposition to be able to share my experience. Strength and Hope is an honor and a privilege just to talk about the transformation and what Al-Anon has done for me and God. But doing it in front of a bunch of people always makes me nervous. But I do it anyway. Again, thanks to all the speakers and panelists. It's just been some really powerful nuggets that I've received all day. So thank you. And I hope that they settle in. I get to process them and emulate them in my life. Set an example of all that I've learned. Oh, boy. Okay. My heart is pounding, you guys. I want to welcome anybody who's new. Please keep coming back. We hear out here in California, we used to always say how newcomers tend to, you probably hear us like Charlie Brown teacher. I don't know if you remember Charlie Brown. Your first meetings could be like, wah, 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 wah. But we ask you to just please keep coming back. I'm not sure it happens in other meetings. I'm sure it does, but we recommend at least doing six to see if you want to stay with us. Just give it a shot, have an open mind, and see what happens and hopefully identify. And I hope that you find this a home as I have. And all of you who have been here before me and have continued to keep coming back, thank you so much. I've learned from each and every one of you. I need you, and you continue to give me hope and inspiration to know that not only that alcoholism has no color, no borders, just that alcoholism is a family disease, and just as much as it infiltrates our life, recovery does make a difference. And so I hope that you keep showing that for me, because that's what I've learned from a lot of people who've been here. So thank you for my life. Oh, goodness gracious. Okay, I've heard so much, you guys. Let's see where I want to go. I'm so nervous. Whenever I'm so nervous, I'm like, all right, God, anytime now. Show up anytime you want. I'm just stalling here. This is your gig. No, I'm just willing. Oh, buying time. Okay. Oh. You know what keeps coming up in my head of saying that I'm an adult child of an alcoholic, but I've never really referred to myself as that. Just that I get an opportunity to just share a little bit with you of what it was like for me and how I ended up arriving with you and how my life has changed in so many ways. But I am an adult child of an alcoholic, perhaps. Not perhaps, but I am. It's interesting because I never really, I learned that language when I came here, but I certainly didn't see it that way. I'm a Puerto Rican from New York City. I grew up half the year in New York and half the year in Puerto Rico. And our family is what some would define as dysfunctional. But as far as I know, it's my family. And I think they're very colorful. My relationship with family members that are all alcoholics and addicts, there's only a few role models as we will call them, Al-Anons, I didn't, certainly didn't see that at the time, is my grandmother, my father, my brother, and my cousin Petra. And they, how they survived us, how they survived is what I emulate, I believe, today, because I learned a lot from them. And then Al-Anon gave me the language of perhaps how they were able to navigate through the all the alcoholism and the drug addiction in our family. But the relationship with alcohol and its disease is a part of its our culture. It has existed for generations. It isn't. It was never referred to as something that's frowned upon or anyone that had issues with it. That's not what I saw growing up. It was a way of life, and we dealt with the drama, the excitement of all of it. It had a lot of color. It was, we like rice and beans, and we listened to salsa, and everyone gathers together. We're very tribal. So even in Puerto Rico and in New York, we tend to live with one another. So there's a lot of family saga, you know, where everyone's in everybody's business. We're always problem solving. We learn to mind each other's business. It's definitely been hard to mind my own business because that's just the culture that I grew up in. You know what everybody's doing at every given time, and everyone gets involved. It's just an immediate reaction. It's interesting. I was in Puerto Rico a few years ago, and it's just embedded in the culture. It's just one thing happens and everybody gets in it. You know what I mean? I remember I had something going on with like with my face. I had like bumps and just laying on the beach. You know, there's a guy going by and he's looking for coins or whatever, treasures. And he looks at me and he goes, "What's wrong with your face?" You know, it's like, and called his wife over and everybody tried to figure out what was going on with my face. And so I kind of just grew up with this dynamic of family, the insanity of all of it, and how we manage through it. And I learned earlier on disassociation. And so I don't recall being invested in any of the darkness, the ugliness of any of it. Because it was such a norm, I immediately learned to not give any emotion, any feeling to what was happening. My mother was always in and out of mental institutions. She was suicidal, I think, since the age of 8. She survived incest. Most of her brothers and father molested her and sexually abused her. I witnessed my mother having, you know, always in these mental institutions, they used to call the Thorazine shuffle or something like that, electric shock treatment. And to make light, and I'll tell you the dynamics of making light of that. We would go and visit my brother and I and play jokes on my mother. You know, she would watch us through the window as we left, and we would play jokes on her where my brother would pretend like he's throwing me in front of a car or gonna kill me, and my mother's screaming, you know, because she's thinking that one of us are in danger. And then one of the orderlies would come up to see what's happening with her, and we would act like, you know, we didn't do anything. And so they're thinking it's her insanity. I mean, these are the jokes that I grew up playing. I'm laughing now. It's not funny, but it was funny. we found those things to be funny and comical. I slept most of the time or slept through her having to go to the hospital. Ambulance always coming to our house, or what we call now the PET team. The drunkenness of drunken bodies laying around the living room was also normal. Bottles of alcohol and beer was always in the refrigerator and around the end table, you know, the coffee tables. I had uncles that were heroin addicts, and they were always passing out, nodding out. I make a joke about it. If anyone would come to visit, I would just, you know, I wasn't embarrassed about those things. I would just say, "Ah, oh, that's my, you know, he'll finish his conversation when he comes back." You know, my cousins or my uncles. If anybody knows any heroin addicts, what they tend to do is they'll have a conversation and then they'll nod out in the middle of it. And then when they come to, I always found it fascinating that they start exactly where they left off. I mean, it was like as though they just have a pause or a commercial break in the conversation. And so I knew that I'll find out what they're going to say when they come back. So I never really was like, "That's horrible." It was kind of like, "He'll finish later." And I learned Also to take care of my mother. I learned to, or my cousins or family, I made sure I knew where the alcohol was. I grew up in the 60s, so you supposed to, you were able to like get a little note from your family, like a family, an adult, that allowed you to go to this corner store and buy the liquor and the cigarettes. And so I was always, in a way, the supplier. I made sure that any of my family members had what they needed. And I wasn't the Al-Anon who was repulsed or disgusted or uncomfortable with the drinking and the drugging or whatever that was going on in my home. I made sure that everyone had what they needed. It seemed as though if they had their supply, they were more subdued and less likely to lash out at me. Because I grew up in that environment, I grew up with verbal abuse, physical abuse, and sexual abuse. And so the insanity of alcoholism, how it, the role that it played in my life was I was the brunt of all of it. And so there were some tools that I learned earlier on. And that was to be a fly on the wall, to not make any noise. It was, it's almost like I learned that question of how are we doing today? How are we feeling today? Are we happy today? Because if we're happy today, then we can have fun. If we're sad today, then let's be sad. It was, I learned to be a we, not a I or a me. The implementation of other-centeredness, in the sense that I understood it then, was essential for my survival. At no time could I possibly think about what I thought, how I felt, or what I needed to do, or what was important for me. What was significant was what was important for all those around me, and that it was my responsibility to fulfill that or to accomplish that. Because the consequences and the ramifications of not doing so were far greater. I remember going, I love conferences, and I love Alateen, and I always remember an Alateen saying something that really set with my identification, which was the Al-Anon, right? The adult has the ability to leave, but the Al-Anon can't, right? The child must remain in this environment. They don't have a choice to leave. And if we do, where do we go? And I associated with that with my brother had shared with me at the age of, he was 8 and I was 5. And he packed our bags. He said he packed these little suitcases, and he announced to my mother that he was leaving and taking me away from this insanity. And my mother said, great, go, leave, get out of here, I don't care. And we went downstairs, we lived in the projects, and he said we went downstairs, and he stood in front of all these tall buildings in this big city of Manhattan and wondered where he would go with me at that age. And ultimately, the doom of knowing that we had to go back upstairs. And his mission from that moment on was to figure out how we would escape. So he spent the next 10 years until he was 18 plotting and strategizing that he can get us out of this home. And so you figure from there moving forward, we actually spent the next 10 years living in the insanity of that and how to survive it. And what he survived it through sports, and I survived it by disassociation and pleasing. And providing the needs of those around me. At no time did I think that there was something wrong with any of that. I don't remember looking at other families, questioning or comparing to mine. Because we're tribal and we hung out with only each other, that was the only thing I was exposed to. And so I didn't see anything else differently. As I got older, I left at the age of 14. I was actually emancipated by a judge. I ended up going to juvie. I came out, and the evaluation with the judge was that I had an IQ that was absolutely ridiculous. I could do the judge's job at that moment if I needed to. The judge also told my mother that I was not a juvenile delinquent. I did not have issues with authority figures. I was very compliant and submissive, but also stated that what they found fascinating was that if they left me alone longer than 5 minutes with my mother, I would have an entire personality change. And that is when I became aggressive and violent and defiant. And so I always remember that my decision for the decision the judge made for emancipation was that it would be impossible to place me in another home because of my maturity. And they found that the only issue I had at the time, they claimed, was my mother. And so they weren't going to place me, and they couldn't send me back into the home. And so at the age of 14, I was claimed to be an adult. And so with the tools that I had learned growing up for those 14 years, I went out into the world and lived on resilience, acting as if I would pretend to be far more mature than I believe I actually was. You use term, I don't know about people pleasing, because people pleasing, I believe, has its own agenda. I just was accommodating. All of my relationships were extremely volatile and dysfunctional. Anyone I got involved with was an alcoholic or an addict. And I, too, in that role, made sure that they had all the alcohol that they needed and that their well never went dry. I kept them highly supplied. I built relationships with bartenders, liquor stores, drug dealers to ensure that if they ran out or that they didn't run out. I mean, I hear a lot of stories now and on. That's one you hear much. Like, I wasn't fighting for them not to do it is what I found fascinating about that. At no time did I go into, oh, you can't, please stop. I don't remember saying, if you love me, you wouldn't. It was, and if I love you, if I care enough about you, then I need to make sure that you have what you need. I didn't associate it with them being sick and I was providing medicine. I just knew that they did not do well when they didn't have it. And so in order for them to be okay, which would mean I'm going to be okay, I made sure you had it. And that's what I spent my life doing, was ensuring that all those that I was in a relationship with, that they had what they needed, because somehow, if they did, I wouldn't get beaten, yelled at, mistreated, abandoned, disrespected, thrown away. It's just interesting. And at the same time, we talk about the insanity of that, they did it anyway. So what I began to learn there was that no matter what I did, I was never enough for the alcoholic. No matter how much I loved you, you would never be satisfied. No matter what combination or strategy that I would contrive, I would plan, it was never enough. I was never enough. I'm a spreadsheet, they call it A-type personality. My home was immaculate. My home looked like a magazine. I felt that if I kept everything on the outside in some kind of order, it would never give the impression of how ugly things were. I also learned how to make sure that I looked put together. I mean, I look at pictures and I'm sharp, man. My hair is immaculate. My clothes are neat. I had money. It was almost as though it was a performance, but of course I didn't know I was doing that at the time, right? I've learned that since I've been here. But to ensure that my world, as I perceive it, to have some control and some manageability, was to put everything in its order outside of me. And that began earlier on, whether I would see a therapist, youth programs, mentorship programs, I always looked right. I always had a smile. I would be bruised and bleeding, and I was always smiling. Many therapists just had a hard time trying to get me to see that something was wrong, and I would always say, there's nothing wrong. Everything is perfectly fine. Everything is okay. I don't even see why I'm here. because I believe that as long as I managed and controlled what I thought I could, that if you were okay, I was okay, if it looked okay, then we were all okay. And that's an exhausting job. And we call it, I learned the language here, which is playing God. But certainly at the time, I don't remember saying I'm playing God, right? I'm playing because I had a relationship with God. I went to Catholic school for 11 and a half years. I had spiritual and religious practices from an African tradition, a Caribbean tradition. I was a healer at a young age. I did prayer and meditation. I went to church on Sundays. I did my confession on Saturdays. There was drumming, and I had relationships with deities and spiritual beings. And no one ever said to me that what I was doing was wrong. What was happening around us was wrong. My family's behavior was inappropriate. Everything seemed to support and validate that insanity. So why would I consider that the alcoholic life is abnormal? Because everything around me supported the alcoholic life as appropriate, and no one was changing it. And somehow I learned the only way for me to change it is to change how I interacted in it, how I lived in it, how I survived in it. And there's so many stories of the insanity that I live trying to keep up with that. Pieces of me, my identity was only defined by all those around me. That I had no identity by the time I came to you. It was what others thought of me and what they said about me that determined who I was in the world, including my jobs. And I didn't lose jobs, I got promoted. Of course I got promoted. I'm a great protege. I'm a wonderful student. I'm compliant. I don't mind sitting at the foot of an employer and following every direction and making sure that I make no mistakes. I'm a no mistake kind of person. Do you know what I mean? Like, we're not making a mistake. And even if it's your fault, somehow it's mine. I was convinced by others that everything and anything that I did that was a failure had nothing to do with them and had everything to do with me. Regardless if I was given some poor direction and I followed it, it was still my fault. Somehow it was my fault. And that task of doing that is exhausting. It became very lonely as I got older, that I had no one. I had nothing. And I don't know if I refer to as God abandoning me. I just believe that God was a separate energy or entity, or that other spiritual realm was another world that was separate and apart from me. And that I was here in this, what I call planet Earth, by myself. And somehow I needed to discover my own tools in order to get through it. And death was very appealing to me. It seemed that living was a curse, that I was doomed in some way in this dimension. I remember hearing in church, I remember in Catholic school, they talked about limbo, going to a place of limbo before we go to heaven. And I remember thinking Earth was limbo for me. I'm in limbo waiting for the day that I can go to heaven, waiting for them to get me out of here. And I was just tired of trying to live in this thing called life that I found destructive, ugly. I became extremely self-righteous and judgmental, but you didn't know about it. I had an opinion about everything and everyone, but my voice was never heard, so I kept those things to myself. But the conversations that went out on my head, man, they were like, oof. And when I had an opportunity to actually start what I thought run my own life, I became more and more overly manageable. I'm a spreadsheet person, man. I'm a compartmentalize and make sure I dot the I's and cross the T's and have my to-do list. And, you know, just, I didn't know I was like trying to run the show. I was just, this is how we have to live. I had no voice, no opinions. Life was always happening to me. I said I lived in a state of victim consciousness. Everything and everyone was doing things to me. I didn't know how to take responsibility for anything. It was happening to me. And I was cursed. I always believed I was cursed. It still comes up today. If you ask me sometimes when I'm going through something, if there's one word that comes to mind, what is it? I would say I'm cursed. I wasn't wanted when I was born, and somehow there was always this thought of my defiance. My defiance came from I was unwanted, unloved, and unnecessary and insignificant. I wasn't wanted. My mother made it very clear. And it seemed as though I was defiant to come into this world. I insisted on coming here when I wasn't supposed to. And it seemed to me that the world kept reminding me that I do not belong here. And I got exhausted from trying to fit in this planet Earth. And no matter what I did, I didn't fit and nobody loved me. And I couldn't make the alcoholic happy. They were never satisfied. And I was fully responsible. I came to California in March 29 of 1990. And I was led to Al-Anon by a woman named Annie. I was broken, lost. I say I had no name, or I had been a human doing rather than a human being. And all of the strategies and all of the tools that I had used had abandoned me, and they were no longer allowing me to get through a day. I wanted death to take me out, and it didn't. And Annie talked to me, and I began to share with her a little bit about the life I had come from and my exhaustion. I was exhausted. I was exhausted of pleasing. I was exhausted of trying to figure out my life. I was exhausted of pretending. I was exhausted of the lies, the secrets. I would say I felt like the visual image I give you, I felt like the portrait of Dorian Gray. If anybody's seen the, it was, and I love that visual because especially the black and white, I know they did it over, it wasn't the same. The black and white was powerful because he looked immaculate, you know what I'm saying? But that portrait was just horrific. And I felt as though the portrait had been exposed and I couldn't keep this up anymore. And to me, that terrified me more than anything. Not that I had been living a lie. What terrified me was that the lie was exposed. You know what I mean? And there was no way to shut that door again. And Annie told me, I want you to meet me at this place tomorrow at this time. And I just remembered that it was across the street from a park. And why this is, I have a lot of snapshots. When you disassociate, you never come back in your body is what I learned. I lived, hovered over myself, just always like watching everything happening to me. And so I just remember she had me meet her. It was a gym. It was a building with a gym, but she took me across the street. And I guess this is what stands out to me the most. Before we went in, we went across the street and there was a park. And she just wanted me to sit in this park. And it was so odd. There was no talking. There was nothing she was asking me other than to just sit before the meeting started. And I guess it was an invitation to just be, because for the first time, I wasn't manipulating what we were doing. I didn't have to be anything for her. She wasn't asking me to do, to be included in us sitting there. I was just able to sit. And somehow when I was just able to be, it seemed as though I don't know if I was coming into my body, but I became aware of the things around me. I became aware of how I felt. I heard the birds. I felt the warmth of the breeze. And I felt connected with both of those things. I don't know how else to describe it. I feel emotional about it. It was very strange. And I got scared because I had not really been in my body. And it seemed as though she knew it. And all she did was she took my hand and she told me it was going to be okay. And that I was not alone. And we went across the street and I sat in this Al-Anon meeting, and that was April 5th of 1990. And she told me to try my best to listen to similarities, just to listen, to have an open mind. I was given the questions, you know, there's questions on the Al-Anon, and to see if somehow there's something in there that fits with my experience. They gave me, I don't remember if it was before or after, but I got like the little newcomer package. I know it's changed a little bit now, but they gave me a little packet of some information. And instantaneously, somehow, I felt safe. I belonged. And I was not alone in this sense. I was not alone. It was like they began to talk about things that I thought was normal. And they spoke about it in a way that was interesting to me. They began to say that alcoholism was an illness, that they weren't bad people. I don't know, that's what I heard. We aren't bad people. I didn't hear the slander. Like, you know, I mean, I thought originally we'd go and talk about the alcoholic. If anything, I was excited about we could finally talk about these horrible people. They began to talk about themselves and the role that they play in the lives of others and what that meant to them and the insanity of alcoholism. And I thought it was fascinating to hear how insane the Al-Anon is, if not more insane than the alcohol. And that the alcoholic may have an allergic reaction to alcohol, but the insanity of alcoholism lived in the mind and the spirit. And that's what makes this a family disease. And that there was a solution. And the solution that you found, I got the slogans first, live and let live. Let go and let God. One day at a time. Who lives in one day at a time? Not the world I come from. The world I come from, not only do I have to make sure that I pay attention to the past, but I got to get ready for the future because the shoe's going to drop at any moment. I have to be, I have to have like a care package. You know what I mean? A survival package for tomorrow, man. It's so unpredictable. There is no way I'm going to live in today. Just today, anything's going to be liable to happen tomorrow, and I need to be ready. It's almost like I have to have a parachute. I had like a kit, you know what I mean? Ready for tomorrow. Bandages, all kind of stuff. And that I can let go. For the first time in my life, I really felt that I can let go of me being in charge. And that was a relief to me. I don't have words to describe the oxygen that I received with that idea. That I know, it was almost like, I always use the example that I'm no longer the CEO of Teresa Incorporated. I am no longer the CEO of everybody else's life. It was such a relief to find out that I am now being fired from this job that I've had for 24 years. I came to you at the age of 24. For 24 years, I had this assignment, self-appointed, or perhaps by others, that I was in charge of so much at such a young age. And I no longer needed to be in charge. That what I was going to find was a group, a support, that I was not alone because I had this group. And it seemed as though the group was the higher power that I had first. Because all of you as a collective unit, and maybe there's an association with the tribal understanding that I have, that there was a different tribe here than the tribe that I had come from, right? That there was a new tribe, and that this tribe was going to empower and uplift and help me to find this power that lived inside of me. And that the power that you found was the power that I had an opportunity to discover for me that now was going to live, help me to live this thing called life without me having to figure it out. And the word detachment was interesting because I had lived disassociated, and I began to learn that detachment and disassociation were two different things. I learned here that I have an asset. And the asset that I have, I thought it was a liability. And the asset was that I am other-centered. And that's a quality that I have. But it was misdirected on where I used that asset. That how it became a liability was that I was investing that asset in situations and people that they themselves couldn't even change. I love the three C's that stood out to me. I can't change this. I can't cure it. I'm not the cause of it. New language. I didn't cause it. You know, all my life I was told that I was the cause of their misery and sadness and depression, the manipulation of that. I was just telling someone the other day, because I've been talking to one of my cousins, fascinating how I was told. And I didn't know this was manipulation. I was always told how incompetent, what an idiot, incapable, a failure, retarded, and insignificant I was, but yet I was responsible for everything. It's just interesting, the odds of that. And I fell for it every single time. And what it did was I would try to, I would try to prove that I wasn't all those things by doing whatever they wanted me to do. I was like, I didn't even know that. And my life began to change because it changed because I had the courage to change. I like the courage to change, the slogans. I always say I didn't learn about setting boundaries and self-care. And I learned that if I was to incorporate these 12 steps in my life, as each and every one of you have, that I was going to begin to experience a dismantling of my distorted perception of not only alcoholism and the insidiousness of that illness, but it was also going to dismantle my hidden, and I say it's hidden because this is what I learned, my hidden selfish and self-centeredness. And it's hidden because I mask it with my other-centeredness. And that when it was all said and done, I was always driven by me, my wants and my needs, and the way I think the world should be and how it should look and what you should do and how you should be. Of course I know better, because I know how to dot the I's and cross the T's, and I have spreadsheets, for goodness sake. Did anybody get the memo? And I'm always problem solving, so why wouldn't I have all the answers? And if anybody would just follow my direction, we'll be okay. And that was going to be dismantled, because I now was going to be able to put one hand in God and one hand in this program, and I could now become the observer. And I could start trusting in this process. And that my responsibility here was no longer changing the world and changing everybody or fitting myself to the world and everybody. But my sole responsibility was to build a relationship with a power that was greater than alcoholism, than you, than me, than abuse. And then I would experience self-love. I would experience self-care. Because I don't know how to do that. If someone was to say to me, I need you to go practice self-care, how could that mean anything to me if my distorted perception is self-care is taking care of you? I mean, how is that possible? Of course, I don't know how to say no. But if I apply these tools in my life, I begin to now watch myself begin to say yes and no according to the assignment that God has given me. That the assets of who I am is that I can be an other-centered, caring, compassionate person. But where do I put that energy? I use the term, what is my assignment, God? Not what my mother thinks, my cousins think, other people think. But God, what do you think? Where do you, and I learned about intuition, listening to that intuitive thought, to be okay that when I say, that's not my assignment, this is not my responsibility, no, I cannot do that for you, and someone is telling me that I am horrible for doing that to them, that I'm still able to walk out the door. That's huge. That's what we discuss in our meetings and our home group and our literature and my sponsor. How do I do that when I have someone in their disease and I have relationships with my mother sober? I still see the disease of alcoholism. Some alcoholics believe just because they go to a few AA meetings, all of a sudden all is well. You know what I mean? I'm in AA now. You know what I mean? Party. It's like, oh, no. The disease is still, I don't understand. The behavior is still there. I don't get what you're talking about. We're going to wipe the slate clean. I remember my mother made amends to me. I was like, whatever. You know, like, okay. Like, oh, so now all is well, you know. Anyway. How do I love the alcoholic and know that it is not the person, but is the disease of alcoholism and the way it manifests in our lives? I began to then understand the difference between the two. I don't have to like the disease of alcoholism, just like I don't like the disease of cancer and diabetes. I don't like it. It robs us of our life and all that touch the sufferer. It just does. I don't have to like it, but it's not the person. And it began to give me compassion. But the type of compassion that it gave me, and tolerance and patience, wasn't the type of compassion, tolerance, and patience and forgiveness that says, so I can be swept up in the insanity of the disease. That's what I learned about detachment. I'm not responsible for that, and neither are you, but I don't have to stay and get the brunt of it either. I had to learn how to have fun. I literally, my sponsor, I had to do stuff like go to Disneyland. I mean, I had never did any of those things. I don't know what it is to turn off my phone. Do you know what I mean? I'm always waiting for any crisis to happen, and I'm on call 24/7. And even to this day, I have to get a, you know, I have to be given that assignment. It's kind of like my phone does stay on. I've been living the last 30 years in major crisis. I have a lot of family members that have switched from alcoholism and as a result of alcoholism, all of these illnesses. I am a caregiver to most of my perpetrators and my abusers. I'm a caregiver. And you know what? I'm good at it. I don't beat myself up about that today. I'm good caregiver. Of course I am. I'm an Al-Anon. I'm not thinking about me. I mean, I know how to ask the questions that I need to ask. But what also Al-Anon has taught me is that I don't have to take it on myself. I can use what's called resources. You know what I mean? I can build a village of help. I had to learn how to ask for help and that there is no shame in that. That asking for help doesn't mean I'm incompetent or a failure, incapable. On the contrary, it means the opposite. That I have the honor and the privilege of allowing someone else the gift and honor and privilege of giving. And that we do this together. It's interesting, my mother has Alzheimer's. Some people on here know my mom, and mommy has Alzheimer's. And since 2005, mommy's had 4 strokes and she had cognitive impairment. I've been dealing with my mother's cognitive impairment according to dementia since 2005. And I remember when I was sitting with the doctor and they were telling me that she needs, you know, major care and asking me to take on that role and what to do. And mommy started crying. And I remember saying, you need to give me a minute. Because one part of me, despite all the work I have done, I've been waiting for mommy to come home and be a mom. And what you're telling me is she ain't never coming back. You need to give me a minute. The other thing that you're saying to me is quite interesting because she's never taken care of herself. And now what you're asking me to do is to take care of her, and I don't understand what's different about this is what I told the doctor than what I've been living my whole life. And the doctor said the only difference is that back then, if you didn't show up, somehow she would have to figure out how to do it for herself. And now she can't do it at all. You need to give me a minute. Is this my assignment? It's interesting through the years since 2005, I've done a dance, I always say, with my mom. I've had to uncover, discover, discard, get rid of, live and let live, let go and let God, apply every single principle you have given me to find peace, serenity, to know the difference between her alcoholism and her dementia. I think it's kind of funny, but I always say all of her behavior on the dementia is just like alcoholism. I don't know if anybody knows what, especially take an alcoholic who doesn't go to meetings, have a sponsor, work on steps, and has this diagnosis of Alzheimer's. I'm like, I had a sponsee laughing the other day. She walks around like she's drunk. You know what I mean? She don't remember anything. I'm kind of like, in some ways, I've been practicing this illness for many years. And still, even in the dementia, learning what I don't need to do and what I do and where other people can come in and help. I have found a peace here that I don't have words to describe the peace. What I do know is that it comes from within. I've discovered a sense of self. I know that I don't know. I've come to be okay with not knowing and not having all the answers, and it's not my fault. As a matter of fact, that's exactly as it should be. I read my literature each day so that I can stay focused and stay on track. So that I could be reminded because I forget. I need all of you because I forget. I heard you don't have to dance with everybody, but you need to dance with somebody. That's my sponsor. Somebody knows the insanity that goes on in my head and the battles that I struggle with. I learned that it's okay not to be okay and to tell you that. We joke out here about our Al-Anon greeting is when you meet an Al, what's our greeting? We'd be like, let me tell you. So let me tell you. I love how some people say, I can't complain. I'll be like, I can, but I won't. The other centeredness that I am, I get to use it in a way that is useful, purposeful, and assigned, so that when I show up for it, I know that it's because God's in charge. I get real uncomfortable when people say to me, you know, there's a saying, they would say, you know, you have to put the mask on yourself before you put it on others. I know people have heard that. I always say, what mask? That only happens when you're descending from a plane rapidly. When you're caring for people who are sick and suffering, you're dealing with that all day long. I have to choose my battles. Live and let live. And sometimes I get caught up and I get in the insanity and I get involved. And I'm just so grateful that I get to make mistakes today. I get to not get it right sometimes. I become less and less judgmental about you, about me, about the world around me. I don't know if it's getting older in age, in recovery. There are no big deals. It is what it is. I could try again. I stay teachable. I keep an open mind. And what open-mindedness taught me, if anybody is new, is that, is it possible, Teresa, this is the way my sponsor explained it to me. Is it possible that you don't have all the answers? Is it possible? Not don't tell me I don't have all the answers, because I've been living my whole life getting the answers. You know, if I don't have it, I go get it, right? But to say to me, is it possible that you just don't have it? And that's okay. To just not have all the answers. Is that possible? Yes, it is. And that's okay. And I have a right to be wrong and make mistakes. I love the traditions. I believe Al-Anon speaks more on the traditions than any other 12-step program. I believe that we do that to preserve Al-Anon for surviving. I don't know about your meetings, but our meetings, our Al-Anon meetings, we have signs that be like, Al-Anon only spoken here, you know, because we don't want the alcoholics to take over. It's funny, my brother describes alcoholics in this way. I believe it's a wonderful definition. He says, alcoholics make catastrophic decisions with reckless disregard for other people. And according to Alcoholics Anonymous' own literature, is that they have a spiritual reprieve dependent on their spiritual condition. And selfish and self-centeredness is the root of all the troubles of the alcoholic. And unless treated, that's all we're ever gonna see. So we got 24 hours. We got 24 hours to treat our alcoholism. And any given day that can change. And so why don't I just focus on today? Just today. What am I doing today to treat my alcoholism that is centered in my thinking, that diminishes my spirit, and has me put on a God suit that I will always fail? How do I do that? I stay with you. I read all the beautiful literature that we continue to have. I follow the direction of the 12 steps to the best of my ability. And I let this day happen. And I become a part of everything. Because God is everything. So I always end with God being a show off, just because it reminds me of who's really in charge. The show off that the God that I found here is the one that takes a girl like me, unloved, unwanted, and unnecessary, and transforms and changes me into a woman of dignity, of integrity, of self-respect, and gives me a purpose of service, the purpose of helping others in a way that is clearly defined by this power and shaped and molded. But I also watched the transformation of recovery, not only in Al-Anon, but I watched the transformation that this power does to other alcoholics and the difference that it makes in all of our lives. So I keep coming back, let go and let God. Keep my mouth shut, and I have to do it by physically putting my hand over my mouth. I put pen to paper. I share with someone else. And I feel a sense of peace, hope, and serenity. And I watch the promises come true in my life and the lives of others. I am honored and privileged to have found you by the grace of God. And I'm honored and privileged to be able to help anyone, anywhere. Real quick, I have a quick joke. I just saw it at a conference, which I thought was lovely. If you ever want to know who is the alcoholic in the room or who's the Al-Anon, we were at this conference once and everyone started crying and they passed around the box of tissues. And when the chairperson got up, they were like, you know the difference. And that is, when the tissue went to the Al-Anon, they only picked one tissue. And when it went to the alcoholic, they took half the box. But so I'm going to keep coming back so that I can learn how to take the sufficient amount of tissues that is necessary, not taking just one, because sometimes that's not enough, or taking all of them, or being mad at those who do. Thank you all so much for allowing me to participate in my recovery, and thank you for my life. Thank you, Yvonne.